Good afternoon. Thank you, everybody, for hanging in here for this afternoon. I know it's getting late. My name is Beth Bailey, and I'm going to talk to you about an intervention that we have going in Tennessee related to smoking during pregnancy. I do want to acknowledge my wonderful project manager, Lana McGrady, who I could not do this without, and one of my co-investigators who's in the back, Dr. Judy McCook, who is here with us today, too. I have nothing to disclose. All right. Overview for the session today. I just want to talk to you for a few minutes about some of the research that drove our intervention, some of the key information that informed this. Talk to you a little bit about the Tennessee Intervention for Pregnant Smokers Program, also known as TIPS, what it involved, what we did, and then some of the outcomes related to pregnancy smoking. All right, as most of you in this room know, smoking during pregnancy can have lots of negative consequences for children. When we look at birth outcomes, we see birth weight in particular is impacted, up to 400 grams difference for babies born to smokers and non-smokers. We also see an impact on preterm delivery, although the impact is not as large because we know that smoking affects fetal growth more than it does lead to preterm delivery. And then, of course, these differences in birth outcomes obviously lead to differences in NICU admissions and costs for newborns. In terms of later development on children, in terms of growth in particular, we know that children who have prenatal smoke exposure tend to be smaller, and these effects follow children at age 7 in particular, which is when a lot of the studies have been done. We see that children are still an inch shorter than their peers, those that were exposed to smoke prenatally. Weight, not so much of a difference. In fact, starting at age 7-8, we start to see an increase in obesity for children who were prenatally smoke exposed. But we do know that prenatal smoke exposure has a lot of health impacts on children. A lot of respiratory problems, in particular for children with prenatal smoke exposure. All right, and then in terms of overall development of children, cognitive development, social-emotional development, we see that children with prenatal smoke exposure have greatly increased rates of learning problems. They have about a two-fold risk for attention problems and about a 50% increased risk for problems like oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, those sorts of things. And then children who have prenatal smoke exposure are much more likely to have addictions themselves. So if they begin smoking, they're much more likely to become addicted and to get involved with other substances. All right, a couple other things that really informed the intervention that we did have to do with the dose of smoking during pregnancy and the timing of exposure. So we know that there's a dose-response effect, so that women who smoke at higher levels during pregnancy have children with worse outcomes and are more likely to have children with worse outcomes. And there doesn't seem to be much of a threshold. We see effects with as low as 2 cigarettes a day in some studies, and we know that once you hit about a half a pack or 10 cigarettes a day, that we see just an exponential increase in the problems that children have. So we often talk about this, just more cigarettes per day equals worse outcomes. Okay, so that was important to informing our intervention, but also the timing of exposure. If you know much about the prenatal exposure research in terms of other substances beyond tobacco, we know that the early trimester, the first trimester and into the second trimester, seems to be the most crucial for things like cocaine and heroin and alcohol in terms of the effects that we see. But the emerging research is showing that for tobacco exposure, the most key time is the third trimester of pregnancy. So this is important when we talk about interventions in particular, because what we know is that if we can get a woman to quit, even if she doesn't quit until later in pregnancy, we can see significant health gains for her child. And also with this idea of not having necessarily a threshold, but an increasing effect, we know that if we can get a woman to cut down during pregnancy, even if she doesn't quit completely, that we can see health effects. So those were two important things that informed our intervention. All right, now I want to tell you a little bit about where our intervention was. Northeast Tennessee, which is the pink area on the map, overall nationally we know that about 12% of women smoke during pregnancy. In Tennessee, the rate is much higher. This is tobacco country at 17%. But in Northeast Tennessee, we see rates of pregnancy smoking over 30%. People often don't believe me when I go and talk about this. We have two counties, in fact, in Northeast Tennessee, where the percentage of women who show up at our hospitals to deliver is over 40% of women are smoking. Okay, so very high rates of pregnancy smoking. Obviously, this is an area where we do need intervention. We need significant intervention.
In Kentucky, I live in the county with the highest smoking rate at right at 50%.
Okay.
So we have just above that orange place in Tennessee, right above that. It's where we are located.
Are you in Harlan County?
No, Jackson.
Jackson, okay.
We're in that little area.
You're right there. Okay.
And so we have almost 50%.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's tobacco country. This is very low socioeconomic status, and smoking is just rampant. And there is no stigma, really, associated with smoking during pregnancy. So it's very, very common. All right. So in January of 2007, we were funded at East Tennessee State University to start an intervention program to reduce pregnancy smoking rates in Northeast Tennessee. We were funded for 4 years. They were very generous. And when we started showing good outcomes, we were refunded for 2 more years. So we are actually coming to an end this December. Our funding climate has changed in our state capital, so we do not expect to be refunded, even though we have shown some very good outcomes. All right, the program itself is multifaceted because what we realized was we needed a climate change in Northeast Tennessee in order to have an impact related to reducing smoking during pregnancy. So we have targeted physicians, we've targeted nurses, doing a lot of training in 5-ACE counseling, getting them to work with patients, making sure they're always asking patients about smoking. We have worked with the hospitals and doing things at delivery and postpartum, or women who come in preterm labor at risk pregnancies, doing educational training. We go out to the community. We've worked with prenatal education classes. We've worked with a lot of different intervention types of programs to talk about smoking. Developed a whole bunch of self-help materials that are culturally specific. Southern Appalachia is a culture into itself, and a lot of the materials that are out there and available simply aren't appropriate for this population, and so we've really had to work to develop some appropriate material. But number three here, which is highlighted, is what I'm going to talk to you about today. This is the most expensive component of our program, but also the most successful component of our program. And this is what we call case management services, so that we didn't scare women with the idea of, here's a smoking cessation counselor, which is what they were, but we introduced them as case managers, that they were going to help them with some issues related to health behaviors and pregnancy. So we kind of backdoored our way into talking about smoking. All right, women were eligible in the 6 counties in Northeast Tennessee. All women who presented at a prenatal care provider in the 6-county area was eligible to participate in the program. Now, 6 counties may sound like a lot to those of you in urban areas. This is only 6 provider offices, and it's centered in 3 counties. So we had 3 counties where there were no prenatal providers at all. But they drew women from those counties and these other practices. So women that were current smokers, women that were exposed to significant secondhand smoke, or were former smokers less than 2 years quit, because we obviously were going to target potential relapsers. We trained, as we said, the prenatal care providers, and so all the providers at the practices where we had case managers, the providers were also on board. They were also working with the women. The case managers themselves, the model that we used, and I really have a hard time kind of describing our program in terms of the case management approach, it's based on the 5-ACE. Okay? So we have a 5-ACE model that we're trying to stick to, but I kind of call it an expanded 5-ACE model because these case managers were trained smoking cessation counselors, so they had a fair amount more experience than a lot of people who typically implement a brief 5-ACE. And they worked with them longer, so anywhere from 10 to 30-minute sessions they had with the women. And it was very much based on motivational interviewing. So it was very patient-guided, patient-directed. We've had a very hard time looking at fidelity with this model because the key is let the patient guide the intervention. And so how do you can't say, okay, did you do this, this, and this with the patient? No, if the patient wanted to go in this direction, that's where you went. So we're still really struggling with how do we expand this model out in terms of describing it. But I guess the key is that it's patient-centered, and so the patients are really driving this intervention. When the case managers met with the patients, in addition to talking about smoking issues, they also dealt with life issues. This is a very low socioeconomic population with a lot of issues. So if you have a woman who comes into the office and she doesn't know where she's going to sleep that night, okay, that's her bigger priority, obviously, than smoking. And so helping these women deal with some of these other life issues in order to start being able to talk about smoking. So it was often not until they met with our case manager once, twice, 3 times before smoking would even become the primary focus of the interaction. Referrals to needed services, obviously. Domestic violence became a big one that we were dealing with quite a bit in these rural communities, and helping women with that issue, and depression and stress were also key. So we had to really target those things before we could really have a successful smoking intervention. All right, so in terms of the overall objective of this report in particular is evaluating the effectiveness of the case management services. So looking at how effective were the case managers in getting women to quit smoking and in affecting outcomes. All right, phase one of the TIPS program, which was about the first 3.5 years or so, we had over 1,200 women that met with these case managers in the practices. Well, we had 1,200 that were eligible. About 88% of those agreed to participate. So we were really pleased with the number of women that were willing to sit down with one of our case managers. Most of these women had smoked for a while, it was intergenerational, but we had 88% that were willing to sit down and talk with us at least once. Smoking status, obviously, self-report. In this community, I have been surprised. Self-report is a pretty accurate indicator of smoking. A lot of times when it's more stigmatized, you can't necessarily rely on self-report. But self-report has lined up over 90% with urinary potenine and ectal carbon monoxide. So we did use those, but as it turns out, self-report was pretty good. All right, at the time of the first meeting with the TIPS case manager, we found that 27% of the women were already considering quitting or had started trying to quit. So they might have had one failed quit attempt, they might have been quit for a week, they might have said, well, I'm thinking about quitting, can you help me? So we had really about a quarter of the women that were already interested in becoming engaged. And in working with these women, about 80% of them successfully quit and stayed smoke-free to delivery. So that was something we were very happy about. In addition, the other, 73% that were quite resistant, not at all interested in quitting, about 7% of those women actually quit and stayed smoke-free to delivery. So when you look at the numbers overall, we had a 28% smoking cessation rate during pregnancy. All right, here's a breakdown. As you can see, there's our 28%. But I think it's also interesting to show, we tracked obviously a lot of different things. You see that a lot of women had at least a quit attempt, even if they didn't quit smoking, reported reducing their smoking significantly. Only 12% of women had no change in smoking behavior at all in the course of working with our case managers. So I think that was something when we initially started, our quit rates were kind of low. We were looking at only those women who weren't even interested in quitting, and that 7% was very discouraging to our staff. And I said, well, no, really, the overall quit rate is this. And then when you start looking at changes in behavior, only 12%, a little more than 1 in 10 did nothing in terms of changing their behavior. And there was a meta-analysis out in 2008. It's probably not as recent anymore as I say there, but has shown that if you look at smoking cessation interventions during pregnancy that are similar to this or more intensive than this, or less intensive than this, that they show about a 15% quit rate. So I think we were doing very good at the quit rate that we had. All right, we also targeted secondhand smoke exposure because in this culture, if a woman wasn't smoking, she was often living with a smoker. We didn't have as much success with getting women to eliminate secondhand smoke. They reduced it, but very few women were actually able to completely eliminate secondhand smoke exposure. And again, this is its culture, it's endemic. Everywhere you go, people are smoking. It's very hard for a lot of these women, too, who don't have a lot of control over their environment. They're living with extended family members who smoke, and it's the extended family member's house, and so they really didn't have control over that piece of their environment. All right, in terms of birth outcomes, and now we have many of these, but I just chose to put two up here. Now keep in mind that these two groups are not smokers and non-smokers. These are all women who entered pregnancy as smokers, but the ones who quit smoking are the ones who quit smoking by the end of the second trimester. As you can see here, we had a pretty significant reduction in low birth weight births. It's about a 36% decrease. So again, these were babies who were exposed to smoke early on in pregnancy, but didn't have smoke exposure at the end of pregnancy. The preterm birth rate, again, wasn't significant. We have a number now, and we've finally gotten below that 0.05%. But I think it's important to show that what this is that we have a restriction of fetal growth, not necessarily preterm births that are occurring. All right, so what this is really showing here is that it's not ever too late to quit. All of these women who quit, most of them didn't quit until the second trimester, and most of them were bumping right up to 30 weeks before they actually quit completely. All right, so something funders always want to see is a cost analysis of what did they get for their money. The first 4 years of the program, and this is data from the first 3.5, so pretty close, about $1.4 million is what the program cost to run. We had a savings of $3.63 million in newborn costs in the region related to this reduction in preterm birth alone. And these are newborn costs. These are not long-term health costs, even to the first year, into educational expenses. Newborn hospital costs only. So, you know, we've been pushing to the state. You've really got a lot of bang for your buck here in terms of prevention effect related to health care expenses. All right, the last issue that we examined was factors affecting program success. So looking at what in the program worked and what in the program didn't work. And this is really what kind of drove the second phase of the project. A lot of factors were related to program success, and they really varied. It was really kind of hard to nail this down in terms of, you know, what worked, because what worked for one woman didn't work for another woman. You know, it seemed to be very person-specific. But these are some of the things that we found to be fairly universal. Women who met with the case manager more times were more likely to quit, although we did have kind of a curvilinear relationship, because the women who were having the hardest time quitting often met with the case manager a lot of times, too. So this effect wasn't as strong as it might suggest. Assistance with mental health issues. The women who were depressed, who had a lot of stress, were much less likely to quit, and so we found that if we could work with them to address some of the mental health issues, they were much more likely to quit. Assistance with practical problems, like I said, housing security, food security, all of those types of things were key in terms of building a relationship so that they could then go on to help them with their smoking. Cessation assistance for partners. This was one that we went in, I guess, naively not thinking about. And thinking, okay, we're going to work with the woman and she can drive this change at her house and in her relationships. No, 1 year in, we realized that when our quit rates were quite low, the biggest barrier was all the other smoke in the house. And so by year two, we were having our case manager. These were prenatal appointments. It was done in the context of a prenatal visit. So often the partner was there, mom was there, grandma was there. We would haul them all in to meet with the case manager. Let's talk about smoking. And so let's talk about what we can do to reduce smoke in the home. So oftentimes women would say, when we would sit there with them and they would be there alone, will you talk to my husband next time? Will you tell him how bad it is for him to keep smoking? And so, you know, it was this whole involve the family, involve the community approach that was really important. And then intimate partner violence. We found that the women who had, who were experiencing intimate partner violence were the ones who were least likely to be able to affect change in their environment. You know, they had a partner that was encouraging them to smoke, a partner who was certainly not willing to give up their own smoking. And so then there was a lot of relationship dynamic issues we had to deal with. All right, so in conclusion, we found that most women were willing to participate in the program, which we were pleasantly surprised with. You know, 88% was pretty good. We found that we were very successful in helping those who were already somewhat motivated to quit and stay smoke-free. We also found that there was some help for the very resistant women if we could build a relationship to help them remain smoke-free as well once they were able to finally cut down and then quit. We had great success with getting women to cut down, so we had to really think about what our goals were. You know, we went in thinking the ultimate goal is getting everyone to quit. Well, we were much more successful at getting women to cut down, and so that was something that kind of drove our refunding as we went forward. Second phase of the program, as I said, has been underway and has really taken from the idea that we need to meet with the women as many times as possible. We need to make sure that we address a lot of the other life stressors. Okay, that is it. Thank you very much.